Welcome back to the Birder's Guide, everybody. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking this is not Friday. This is new, very interesting, very exciting. And you're not wrong. It is very exciting. I've been toying with the idea for a little while of having some international guests on. I don't really want to take away from being an Australian podcast, so my plan is not to change anything and continue to have Australian people on once a fortnight. But, you know, there's also plenty of international birding going on around the place. So on an irregular basis, I don't know whether it will be once a week or a fortnight or a month or just whenever there are people available, I would probably suggest that it will be around about the once a month mark. Whenever people are available who have done something interesting, I'm just going to get them on the show and have a chat about what they're up to. So I'd be very interested to know what you think. If you do listen to this podcast and you liked it or didn't like it, are interested in hearing more from international people, or would rather I just stuck to Australian content, if you could let me know, that would be fantastic. I want to do what people are interested in hearing, after all. So basically that's it. This is the experiment, really. And I'm glad that we've kicked it off. So without any further ado, let's get into the first one.
You're listening to The Birder's Guide with Michael Greenshields.
Now, on the show today, we have got Nate Swick, who is the podcast host, amongst other things, for the ABA, the American Birders Association. I got in touch with him because I listen to his podcast, regularly. I listen to all the ones that come out, and just asked if he'd be interested to come in and chat about himself and birding in the US. So let's get into it. So Nate, welcome to the show. It's fantastic to have you on as our first international guest.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Yeah, glad to break the seal.
Now, am I right that you live in North Carolina?
That's right, yeah. If people are unfamiliar with the geography of the U.S., it is on the mid-Atlantic coast, and I'm quite a ways inland towards the mountains.
Yeah. So I'll be honest and say that I personally had no idea where that was, which is even more embarrassing once I Googled it, because I have a sister who lived until very recently in Georgia, and then another sister who is actually getting married this weekend to an American who spends most of her time in Virginia, both of which border North Carolina. So for everybody listening, and for me actually, what's North Carolina like? Is it hot, cold, mountainous, flat? What's the
So we're in the southeast, so it's a pretty moderate temperature. It can get quite hot in the summers, pretty moderate in the winters. We usually get a little bit of snow, but not a lot. I think it's a pretty fantastic state for birding, because we've got both a really long coastline with some fantastic birding sites right there along the ocean. And of course, pelagic birding out of Hatteras, North Carolina, is some of the best in North America. And then if you go the other direction, you're up in the Southern Appalachian Mountains, which go up to about 6,000 feet. I don't know exactly what that is in metric.
Yeah, that's fine. Feet is fine. Yep.
Yeah, but once you get up in the high mountains, you get some boreal species that you're more likely to find in places like New York or Southern Canada. And so we've got some really neat breeding species up there, like saw-whet owl and hermit thrush and a number of wood warblers. So the diversity of birds here in this state is pretty great. And I enjoy living here. I didn't grow up here, but I've been here for more than 10 years, and I've really enjoyed birding here and the birding community here.
Mm. How did you, or why did you end up in North Carolina?
My wife is in academia, and so she was doing her graduate school at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And when she finished there, she got an academic teaching job at a small university here in Greensboro, which is about an hour to the west of Chapel Hill. And that's where we are.
Yeah, nice.
So I can do my work wherever, so yeah. I just have to follow her along.
Always the benefit. Taking your personal opinion out of the equation, is North Carolina known as a good birding state?
Ooh, boy. You know, here in the ABA area, we have a number of really classic birding locations like California, South Texas, Arizona, Florida. I think it's up there. You know, I would put it up against, you know, the top tier. We are sort of a destination for pelagic birds, at least on the East Coast. And so that means something. We have a handful of, you know, ABA first records to hang our hat on. But, you know, it's top half, top 10%. Well, maybe not top 10% because there's only 50. I don't know if it's top 5. But, you know, it's up there. It's up there. Yep. Yeah, maybe top 10 or 12.
So for those listening in who aren't familiar with America, with the US, what's the ABA area stand for?
So the ABA is the American Birding Association. It's an organization I work for. And, you know, for the last 50 years or so, it's sort of been the organization for hobby birders, essentially. And they established this ABA area, which is sort of the listing area for North American birders, which is pretty much the English-speaking North America. So the United States and Canada, and there's a tiny little French island that we always have to add that's just south of Newfoundland called Saint-Pierre et Miquelon, that's also part of it. And Hawaii, we added Hawaii, which seems, you know, it's part of the United States, but as far as birds are concerned, it's a very different place. But, you know, it's a U.S. state. It's, you know, conservationally, it's our responsibility as Americans. So it makes sense to add it.
Yeah. And does that include Alaska?
It does include Alaska. Yeah. Yeah. That would be another of the really great birding states, if for no other reason, because of vagrant potential. It gets a lot of those East Asian birds.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you get into birding, going back however far that is necessary?
Yeah, so, boy, I've been into nature ever since I was little. My dad was a science teacher. We were one of those families that spent a lot of time outdoors. We lived on a really nice river, and so we'd spend a lot of time floating it and, you know, catching snakes and turtles and all sorts of bugs and things like that. And eventually, my interest has kind of turned to birds. I think they're sort of perfect for a naturalist because there are more species to find than there are, you know, herps, at least, you know, in North America. And snakes and turtles can be kind of hard to find sometimes. And, you know, bugs are too overwhelming. There's too many of them. And there aren't any really great field guides to insects, or at least there weren't when I got started. And birds are just kind of perfect. They're right in the middle. And I started birding pretty seriously when I was 12 or 13 and, you know, kind of kept at it with a couple breaks when I was in college to do other things. But then I came back to it pretty heavily and I've been doing it ever since.
Mm. I think I know the answer to this question just because I listened to your podcast.
Sure. Yeah.
But you said you took up birding when you were 12 or 13. Was birding a cool thing to be in when you were a young teenager?
No.
Yeah. Same as here.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's gotten better. There are so many more young birders. And part of the reason I kind of took a break from birding when I was in high school and college is because I didn't really have that, you know, peer reinforcement.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was the only one. I went to bird camp when I was 14.
That sounds very cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought so. But, you know, looking at it from the outside, maybe not. But, it, you know, it was in Southeast Arizona. It was put on by the American Birding Association and Victor Emmanuel Nature Tours, which is a big nature tour company here in North America, and called Camp Chiricahua. And it was amazing. You know, that was the first time I was ever around other kids who were as into birding as I was. But then you go home, you don't have that peer reinforcement. I got into other things that my friends were interested in, and I ended up having to... took a little bit of time off and then came back to it later when I was a little bit older.
Yeah. So you've now made your career from birds. I assume working with the ABA is essentially all that you do.
Yeah, pretty much.
So what do you do with the ABA?
So my title is digital communications. What that means is essentially any content that is online, I am, you know, sort of either in charge of or involved in. Which is pretty much everything these days now that we can't do any, you know, in-person birding events.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, you know, social media, online content, Some web stuff that we do have web specific people, though I do work closely with them, and you know, hosting the podcast, as you've mentioned, which we've done for about 4 years now. We're in our fourth year.
Yep.
And still going strong.
Mm. And have you been running the podcast the whole time?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it's pretty much been my baby. Me and John Lowry, my colleague here, who is, you know, sales and marketing as his normal job, but he's also in his other life, he's a musician and a sound recorder, and so he does a lot of the technical stuff. I produce the podcast, I choose the guests, I do all the editorial content, and then I kind of send all my interviews and you know, recording that I do on my own over to John, and John stitches it all together and puts together the finished product, and that's sort of our workflow.
Yeah. So how did you end up working for the ABA? How did you get from being a 12-year-old birder to being where you are now?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny journey. Back in the early, mid-2000s, you know, 2000 to 2010, there were a lot of bird blogs online that became, you know, a very big thing. This was the age of the internet before Facebook and Twitter and all that kind of swallowed all that up. But there were a lot of bird blogs, and I wrote one. I was one of those, you know, bird bloggers. I had a blog called The Drinking Bird. And, you know, at the time, the ABA was just, you know, an organization that I was a member of. And then they went through some leadership difficulties, and they hired Jeff Gordon, who's currently the president. And one of the things that the ABA had not done very well over its years was to appeal online, was to have any sort of online presence. And I basically said on my own blog, it's like, hey, ABA, this is what I can do. Why don't you hire me? And it was a long shot. I figured it was a long shot. But, you know, I knew what I could do and what I was familiar with and what the ABA needed. And I felt like there was a good, you know, those sort of dovetailed. And when Jeff was hired, he gave me a call and said, hey, I read your post. We've got a spot for you. Why don't you come in and help edit the ABA blog, put that together. And so I started off doing that, and then as the years went by, I just started adding more and more stuff to my list of responsibilities, and eventually it became something more like a full-time job over the years to what it is now. I look back, and I'm doing a ton more stuff, much more involved in the front-facing part of the organization, which has been great. It's been super to be involved with a group of people where my interests and what the organization wants to do from a mission standpoint are really well intertwined. Yeah. So that's been real satisfying.
Yeah, that's cool. Do you have any training or, what's the word?
I didn't go to school for it. Not really. I mean, I was a good writer, and I had a good following online, and you know, social media was a new beast at that time, and so, you know, I was jumping in. We were all kind of feeling our way through it, and I don't know, like, talking about birds is something I've been able to do, like, I'm happy to do, and so, you know, it's not hard to do that. And you know, I it's hard, like, this is sort of a, you know, now there are probably college courses and degrees that you can go through to do digital communications, but there certainly weren't then. My actual degree is in anthropology, which is not terribly related to birding at all. I just sort of fell into it and found my way and made a position that worked for me.
Yeah, nice. So just jumping back a little bit, I just thought of a question about the podcast. Have you had any memorable guests on your show, like one or two that stand out?
Yeah, you know, sometimes my favorite guests are ones when I go into the interview and I don't really know what to expect. Maybe I personally think that it's a topic that maybe is not quite as exciting as one that I've done in the past, and then it ends up being just a really great conversation. One that happened recently, actually, was the one with Steve McGuire. Just the last podcast, he's a high school teacher that does an ornithology course. I admit, like, I did not know quite what to expect going into that into that interview. But, it, you know, because of Steve being a super charismatic guy and, you know, just being a really interesting topic, talking about kids and birding and how people can, you know, get the birding bug. at a young age and where it might take them. It just turned into like this really great conversation that I really enjoyed. And, you know, based on the response that I've gotten from listeners, like they really enjoyed too, which I didn't necessarily expect going in.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. That's basically exactly how I feel about this episode.
Yeah.
once you agreed to come on, I was like, what the heck am I going to talk about? So I basically decided to go with what is birding in America like, and we'll just see where we end up.
I don't know much about the birding culture and community in Australia either, so we can compare notes, I suppose.
We'll see. One question I did have, and I'm pretty sure I know the answer, but some people might not, is the ABA and Audubon the same thing? Because Audubon's very well known.
Yeah, yeah. There's certainly some overlap. You know, the United States is such a large country with so many people, it makes sense that there might be some different organizations that sort of segment out the birding community. The way I think about it is Audubon is about birds and bird conservation. That's sort of been their purview for as long as they've been an organization, whereas American Birding Association is much more birder central. So it's more about the hobby, the community, the, you know, building skills, field identification, helping you find the birds that you want to see. It's about that experience of birding. And not to say there isn't, you know, overlap from time to time, obviously there is, but, you know, just generally big picture, that's how I kind of see the differences. Audubon also has, you know, this, you know, they've been around for over 100 years now. They've got this huge footprint. It's a massive organization. All the local bird clubs in the United States, many of them are Audubon chapters. So you join your local bird club, your Audubon club, and you're automatically a member of National Audubon. There's a lot of interchange there. Mm. Where we don't have chapters like in the ABA or anything like that. But yeah, that's sort of how it breaks down.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So one of your current pet projects, which I only learned about listening to your podcast, is going through on your own Twitter and renaming all of the species that are named after people. Obviously, the US has been going through a bit of upheaval over this sort of thing.
A little bit.
Have you had much feedback on that? How's that going?
You know, I think from a pragmatic perspective, people are sort of, I mean, we as birders joke all the time about terrible bird names. I mean, there's a lot of them. I'm sure you have them in Australia as well. Like, you know, in the US, we have things like ring-necked duck. Well, you barely even see the ring on the neck. Red-bellied woodpecker. Those are kind of classic examples. So people are definitely open to the idea of making bird names better. And to my mind, like, the worst bird names are the ones that are named after people, because they tell you absolutely nothing about the bird. They don't help you identify it. They don't give you any insight to its behavior or habitat or any of that sort of useful stuff you might want to use to identify a bird. And so as an outreach tool, they're failures.
Yeah.
But it turns out that, you know, a lot of these names are remnants of this time, this colonial period, when, you know, people were getting rid of the native populations here in the United States, and people were doing some awful things to a lot of different people. And so it's, you know, another question comes up is like, why are we even honoring this? You know, they're essentially symbols of these kind of culture of old white man ornithologists that, you know, they were just basically naming birds after each other because they were all friends. They were all like drinking buddies. And so that's where it sort of came from. And we've never really questioned it a lot, although we as birders have been comfortable with name changes over, I mean, you can't be a birder and not, you know, accept the odd name change. So with all that taken into consideration, yeah, it becomes maybe an imperative. I don't know. Maybe it's a good idea to maybe think about renaming some of these birds. One, because so we don't honor these people that maybe don't deserve to be honored. And two, you know, bird names should be for birders. They should be useful for birders. They should be a tool that we use to identify birds and learn about birds. And if they're not that, you know, it makes things more difficult. So that's sort of where that the whole thing comes from. And we did get one. We got McCown's Longspur, which was named after an army general who fought for the Confederacy in the U.S. Civil War. And the authorities decided to change it to Thick-billed Longspur. Now, that may not be be a super useful name, but it's a at least a more descriptive name. And you know, we're there's a number of other people out there who probably are low-hanging fruit to have their names changed too, and so we're kind of looking at that. That's the sort of bird names for birds movement in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think as is probably a little different. I did a little bit of a spiel actually after I listened to your podcast at the start of mine about Australian, and I could only find, I can't even remember the number, maybe 15 that were named after people. And only and there was only, I asked people, if I've got anything wrong here, let me know, and quite a few people did, but there was only one. Only one bird was named after someone with a bit of a sketchy history. So that's quite easy. But we do have some species which just have silly names, like a pink-eared duck does have a pink ear if it's in the right.
It's got that huge bill, doesn't it? That's the like the thing you notice about it, right? Or am I thinking of a different Australian bird?
It should be called the zebra duck. If you ask anybody, what should we call this? It's got stripes down the side.
Yeah.
And it does have a pink ear in good light with a scope closely, you know.
Yeah, we've got to see this.
Yeah. So anyway, as I was saying before, after you agreed to come on the show, I was struggling to figure out what to talk about, because obviously birding in the US that's a big topic. It's fairly broad. So I've picked a few questions, and we'll see where we end up and see what else comes out. So one thing that you guys have that we don't is migration. So we have a few species that migrate back and forth, Papua New Guinea to the top end of Australia and whatnot, but more or less most of our species are residents. So how does migration work for someone from a country without it?
Boy, okay. So are you talking about like migration in general, or how do you bird during migration?
Yeah,
like,
I guess
what are you trying to do?
Yeah, how does migration change the way you bird or impact?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, this time of year, like, you want to get out as often as possible because things are moving, and what is there one day might not be there the other day. Although fall migration, because it's fall here in the Northern Hemisphere, tends to be a bit more slow and easy than spring. You know, in spring, the birds are all so hopped up on hormones that they want to get where they're going as quickly as possible. So like, they just zoom past you, and if you're lucky, if you intersect with them. But fall is great because fall, the birds are kind of taking their time coming back down. And so, yeah, you want to get out as much as possible and see how things are changing. You're definitely attuned to the weather a lot more. I don't know how it works in other parts of the continent, but I know how it works here where I am in North Carolina. It's usually like 2 days after a cold front moves through, when you've had like, you know, 24 to 36 hours of kind of southerly winds. That's a really good time to get out, because you are going to see a lot of birds moving on those days. Also, you're sort of tuned into land forms, so like kind of the geography of where you're birding. In places like Cape May, New Jersey, where fall migration is amazing, it's this peninsula that kind of sticks out on the south part of New Jersey, and so it acts like a funnel. So all the birds that are migrating over land like funnel themselves into this tiny spot at the tip, because they don't like to fly over the water, and they can't really like have good conditions or see the other side, and so they kind of stick there. And so the ends of those little land masses can be really super great places to see a ton of migrants, and that works on a larger and a smaller scale, even where a place like I am, because birds are sort of reluctant to cross over even like a reservoir. So if you position yourself on like the north side of a lake, a lot of times birds will kind of press up against that shoreline, because they want to just kind of generally be moving southward, but they're kind of stuck there. And so a lot of times you can see relatively large flocks of birds. Here in the southern Appalachians, birds will use the mountains, which are generally kind of oriented north-south, as sort of landmarks. And so there are these gaps in the middle of the mountains between two large mountains. And if you can get yourself there at sunrise, you can see the birds kind of reorienting. So they will, like, they'll have overshot where they wanted to be because of various weather conditions or whatever, and then they'll kind of turn back towards the mountains. And so they'll kind of be flying at an angle right over you, or the land where you are, and sometimes you can see lots of birds. So there's like lots of little tricks to kind of put yourself in position to see migrating birds. But that's sort of what I think of when I think of fall migration, like finding a place a lot of times on the north side of a lake or on the south side of like a peninsula or a landmass, and it's kind of like sitting and watching the birds go over. Because on a good day, like, you can see a ton of stuff. I know here in North Carolina where I live, there's a gap in the mountains near Mount Mitchell, which is our tallest mountain in the state. And just off the side of it, there's a little pull-off area on the road. You can just sit there for a couple hours and like just thousands of birds passing over you. A lot of them are too high to identify, but you can see just a lot of migrants a couple of days after a cold front. It's a really neat phenomenon. There's a lot of little things like that in fall migration. Spring's a little bit different, similar sort of stuff, but it's all over so quickly because the birds are moving so fast.
Yeah.
That's why I think fall is better than spring. Because it's slow. You don't feel like you miss it if you miss one good day. I've had places here in the spring migration in North Carolina where if you get like a bunch of south winds for a week or so, like the birds will just migrate over you. Like they'll just keep going and won't stop.
Yeah.
And you won't see as many. So like if you're busy on a Tuesday, it feels like sometimes like you missed migration, like you missed the whole thing. But that doesn't happen in the fall.
Yeah. So when birds migrate, generally speaking, are they... Okay, so you had a guest on your podcast recently. I think it was talking about something along the lines of are birding experts useful in everyday life? But I can't remember the words he used, but one, I think you said the word for brightly coloured and the word for dull were the wrong way round or something or other. But
Yeah, we might have been talking about confusing fall warblers or something like that. Yeah, there's a lot of weird
words. Yeah, but do most birds who migrate, are they bright or are they dull? Are they easy to identify or not?
In the spring, they're definitely easy to identify. Because they're, you know, they've just molted into their brightly colored breeding plumage, and a lot of times they'll pass by really quickly. In the fall, it's a mix. It depends on the bird. Some birds will molt before they head south. Some will molt after. So you get kind of a mix of really clean looking, but maybe not so bright warblers, or like ratty looking grosbeaks and buntings and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's a saying here in North America. It was by Roger Torrey Peterson, who wrote the first field guide, wrote groundbreaking book, but he called the warblers confusing fall warblers. And so everyone here thinks that warblers, wood warblers, are like really difficult to identify in the fall. And there are a couple kind of tricky species pairs, but for the most part, they're not too bad. Most of the time they look like kind of washed out versions of their spring selves.
Yeah.
So if you look for the patterns and the behavior doesn't change, they're still doing the same things if they have any sort of, noticeable behavior. But it's a real mix in the fall. Which is part of the reason why I like it so much.
Yeah.
It's a lot of variety.
Yeah, well that was my next question, was going to be something around the fact that it seems that America has a bit of an obsession with warblers.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know. why is that?
I think they sort of strike the perfect balance between novelty, because there's so many different kinds of them, and ubiquity, because there's actually quite a lot of them around in the spring. And if you go to a good place and you have a good morning, you could see upwards of 20 different species of wood warbler in the spring. And to my money, they are not as drop dead gorgeous as like a tanager or an oriole. They are there's so many different kinds, and they all have their own little things that they do, or unique behaviors or unique places. I think that's what people love about them. There's just so many of them, and they're not too difficult to see, and they're like a really useful way to kind of grade your spring. Like a good spring is one where you see 27 to 30 species of warbler in a spring. A bad spring is one where you only see like 20. So like it's a useful way of determining, how productive your birding has been in the season.
Yeah.
Better than tanagers, where there's only like two likely species, or orioles, where there's only two. There's a ton of warblers, and people love the variety.
Yeah. So this is a question following on from species. This is a question I don't ask people, basically, because you always get the, all of them or the last one I saw answer. But you guys have got a lot of families that bird families that we don't have in Australia, like woodpeckers, hummingbirds, vultures, loons, etc., etc. Do you have a favourite family of birds to find? Like, for me, it's ducks and finches. And if you ask me why, I have no idea. I don't know why. Yeah. That's just my favourite. But do you?
Boy, I really like sparrows.
That's an interesting answer. Most people wouldn't say sparrows.
They're really subtle, and I don't know. You know, they have a lot of really great. I mean, the habitat is usually pretty unique. You can usually find, you know, a good variety of them on a good day's birding. Here in North Carolina, we have a number of coastal species that are sort of unique to our, you know, our kind of salt marshes in the winter, especially. And those are really always great to see because, you know, Nelson's and sharp-tailed sparrow, or not Nelson's and salt marsh sparrow, are kind of like really pretty orange. They're neat birds, and you know, always feel really satisfied when you find one and identify it, or you find an unusual one, or you pick an unusual one out of a flock of, you know, white-throated sparrows or white crown sparrows, the normal species that we'll have here. If I find a Lincoln sparrow, which is this really cute little bird with these really fine, you know, pinstripes that are like marked on with a real freshly sharpened pencil, I feel really good. If I see a fox sparrow, which is not like a terribly uncommon bird where I am, but still not something I see every day, like, that's really neat. Like, I really like those birds. Everyone wants to say warblers, and warblers are fantastic. Like, I'm not going to undersell them at all. They're great, but I like some sparrows, and they usually come in one big wave in the middle of October here, and so I'm looking forward to seeing them in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, nice. A question which is sort of a segue between migration and my next thing. In the movie The Big Year, which I assume everybody has seen. If you haven't, you should watch it. It's pretty good. It's a good birding movie. The scene around the migration fallout on an island or a...
Yeah, High Island. Yeah,
somewhere Texas. Other. How accurate is Hollywood's representation of that?
Well, I mean, as far as the way that the birders are acting, like, really excited, and that's accurate. You know, fallout's not the way that they perceive, the way that they showed it with like birds flying all over the place. Less accurate, because they're mostly like little passerines and stuff that are kind of tucked away in the bushes, and you have to work a little bit for them. But the thing about a fallout is that there's a lot of them, and they're everywhere, and sometimes they're so exhausted that they're just like hopping around on the ground, not even caring about you. And that's sort of what the magic of a fallout. So if people who don't know, a fallout is sort of this sort of perfect conflagration of like geography and weather, where these birds are migrating primarily across a large body of water. In this case, in High Island, it's the Gulf of Mexico. So a lot of birds will take off from like the Yucatan Peninsula and fly overnight nonstop to Texas. And as you can imagine, they are frequently exhausted by the time they get there. Now, if you add maybe a weather system, a front that is coming down and hits the coast at the same time that the birds are coming across, then the birds are going to hit that weather system, and they are essentially going to just drop out of the sky on the first piece of land that they find. And so that's what makes it a fallout. It's that combination of geography and weather. A lot of times if the weather is good and they've got south winds, they'll just like keep going, and they'll just go like however many miles inland, and they'll just scatter into the forests inland, and you'll never see them. But if the weather knocks them down, then like everything that has crossed the Gulf that night is going to be right there on the beach or on the beachside vegetation. And that's sort of the magic of a fallout. And it's a weird thing. I know people get super, super excited about it on the Gulf Coast. It's really great for birders because there's so many birds and they're so easy to see. It's not great for birds because they're completely exhausted searching for food and wherever they can find it because they've been knocked down by this cold front. And so it's a weird, weird kind of feeling. But you know, as long as you have good coastside vegetation, which is the real conservation problem along the Gulf Coast because the beaches are so built up there, the birds will have a place to land and rest and find food. Obviously, the big conservation problem is where they don't have that, and they end up running into people's beach houses and the windows and stuff. But it's the sort of thing that happens, you know, not every year, but some years. And it's the sort of thing that people keep going to High Island for. Like, even a bad day at a place like High Island is going to be pretty good because of the migrants. But you add the possibility of a fallout, people are going to go crazy for it.
Yeah. Have you ever been?
I've never been to High Island. The closest I've ever experienced is, fallouts tend not to happen in the middle of the continent because there's just so many, the whole thing is like the concentration of birds.
Yep.
And so there's so many places where birds can kind of scatter. But I have been in situations where, a cold front will stall right above where I live on a good migration night, and the birds just hit the cold front and they drop, like they land. They're like, I'm done, not migrating tonight. Mm-hmm. we're not doing anymore. And then when you go out the next day, like, you do see a lot of birds. It's not like fallout type birds, but there's a lot of stuff out there that wasn't there the day before, and that's a pretty neat feeling.
Yeah, cool. So moving from migration over to twitching, so I'll phrase this question with some tangibility to it. I asked the question today on the Australian Twitchers Facebook group, how many people have you seen looking at a particular bird at one time? And honestly, I thought the answer would be under 20. For me personally, it's probably about 9. So firstly, thanks to the 20 or so people who gave me an answer. It's a bit difficult distinguishing between at one particular point and during the same day, but the general consensus was around about 70 people for a tufted duck, actually, and a regent honeyeater. So if we take a tufted duck, for example, so the nearest record to where this one was seen is about 5,000 kilometers away. Maybe 3,000 miles, which I did some very quick Googling, would be the same as a seven-colored tanager, which is endemic to Brazil, turning up in Florida. So
that would get a lot of people moving.
Yeah, how many people realistically do you think would turn up to see something like that?
Twitching in the United States is a little bit different than it is in, like, so you see those photos of people in the UK where they're just, hundreds of birders. Because the US is so big, a lot of people don't keep, or people keep their ABA lists and they tend their ABA lists, but the number of people who are going to hop on an airplane and cross the country to see something like that are probably relatively low. Now, there'll be a lot of birders from Florida and probably from the Southeast that would go after that. If it's a reasonable drive, and by reasonable, I probably mean, 14, 16 hours, people would probably do it. I'm not much of a twitcher, so I will chase birds in my state. I keep a North Carolina state list, and even that I'm not as dedicated to as I used to be now that I have kids. But the most I've ever seen is probably in the teens. But I usually am like a day late, and if it sticks around, then I'll go see it. So I've seen, I'm a couple days after the initial rush. I did see it, but we did have a Townsend solitaire, which is kind of a cool little thrush-like bird that was a first record in North Carolina a few years ago. It was at a state park. And so I went and saw that, and there were quite a few people there looking for it when I was there. But that's about it. That was like day 3 that it had been there. It had stuck around for quite a while. Yeah, so what would be what's the twitching situation in Australia? Is it similar? I mean, it's a massive country as well. So if something shows up on the West Coast, it would be hard for like Sydney or Melbourne birders to get to.
Yeah, there would be, I don't know, maybe a dozen people or less that would be, properly interested in flying across the country. Very, very few. But, there's still, like, the tufted duck, for example, that hung around for, I don't know, and it was probably 1,000 people that went and saw that.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems about right. Yeah, I mean, I get the sense that UK twitching scene is so unique to the UK.
But the UK, you can, take you 6 hours and you could be anywhere.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's a lot harder. Like 6 hours here, I mean, I've had really good birds shown up on the coast of North Carolina, about 5.5 hours away. And I've been like, I'm not sure if I'm going to go after that one. I really enjoy that people are looking at it, but I don't need to go see it.
So now this is a question that I ask everyone on my show, which is, where is their bucket list birding spot in Australia, as in where somewhere they have been where everyone else should go at least once in their birding life. But I'm going to ask you a slightly different question.
Yeah, I don't have a bucket list, Australia. anywhere, I think Australia in general is a bucket list location for me. Yep. But,
So my question is this. Let's say I've got 24 hours in the US and I have to stay within, say, a 60-mile radius, 100 kilometers. Where in the lower 48 should I spend those 24 hours?
Well, time of year matters. If I were going to say there was a place to go where you wanted to see spectacle and get as many birds as you possibly could, I would say Northwest Ohio in the first week of May. That's when there's a big festival there, the biggest week, and it is like migratory bird, like a bonanza. Like pretty much all the regularly occurring migratory birds that you could get in the eastern part of North America, you can find there in a relatively short amount of time. And so you can get, you know, all your warblers, tanagers, orioles, thrushes, all that stuff, and get good looks at them and get photographs if that's something you're into. And yeah, relatively easily. Now, if you were other times of year, Southern California is fantastic. San Diego is a wonderful place to bird if you've got a short amount of time, just about any time of year, but especially in the fall. South Florida in the like April would be a great place of time. Great place, a lot of great South Florida kind of tropical-y specialties and the migrating birds that are coming back. But if there was one experience that I think people should not miss, it's that migratory bird spectacle in Northwest Ohio. It's as advertised. Like, it is really, really spectacular.
Maybe one day when we're allowed to swap countries.
I know, right? Yeah.
That'll be awesome. Oh, thanks for coming on the show, Nate. It's been fantastic chatting and learning a bit about the US. And, you know, maybe once the borders are open, I'll probably come over and visit my sister in Virginia, and maybe we can catch up, do some birding.
Yeah, drop me a line. Yeah.
Sweet. All right. Well, enjoy the rest of your day. You're just about to start, and I'm just about to go to bed. And we'll be in touch.
All right. Thanks so much. This was fun.
So thanks, everybody, for listening. Hope you enjoyed that. If you did, or if you didn't, please let me know. There's a thing on my website. There's a Facebook page. There's email. If you happen to know my phone number, feel free to send me a text. I'm definitely interested to know what everybody thinks. And tune in on Friday, which is only 2 days away. We've got an interview with Lindsay Fisher, who, along with her husband Keith, used to own Kingfisher Park in Gelatin. So for the next 48 hours, happy birding.